This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from VPR's John Dillon recapping his observations of the Republican National Convention that wrapped up yesterday in Cleveland. And in the second half of the hour, we'll send you out on your weekend with some light fare, how to give a good wedding toast. But first, we want to get an update on a story we've covered going back many years now. Some Vermont attorneys have been doing pro bono work representing detainees in the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This week, attorneys David Slay and Robert Ginsburg were informed that Abdul Zahir has been cleared for release, 14 years after he was imprisoned in the controversial facility. Joining us now with more information is attorney Bob Ginsburg. Nice to have you back on the show, Bob.
Good morning.
Was it a surprise when you got word that Abdul Zahir would be cleared for release?
After 14 years, almost nothing would be a surprise. I think that both David and I thought when Abdul Zahir finally showed up on a periodic review board schedule that the government had decided that enough was enough, and we kind of had our hopes that it would be successful when we had the hearing 5 weeks ago.
And this periodic review board hearing, this is these were supposed to happen regularly. For a while, they weren't. They seem to be happening a little bit more regularly now. And maybe you can explain what their purpose is.
Well, it's sort of, everything at Guantanamo is really different from anything that we're used to. But I would say that a periodic review board is somewhat like a parole board. The board holds a hearing and gathers information. It's made up of six very high-level government officials, and they try to make a determination whether a particular prisoner would be a threat to the national security if we were released from Guantanamo.
And it would appear that in this case they determined he's not a threat and can be released. That's the reading of that? That is exactly what they are saying?
That's correct. The main point that the Periodic Review Board made in its decision was its conclusion that my client, Abdul Zahir, had been misidentified as a weapons facilitator for Al-Qaeda. So he spent 14 years in prison because the government misidentified him as some kind of a bad actor.
And what was the pretense, or what was the what they had said they had detained him for? You said it's been determined that he may have been misidentified, but what was it that the U.S. government said he had been doing?
Well, basically, they charged him. We actually had a military commission against him started in 2006. He was charged with providing material aid to terrorism. He was a translator from Arabic to Pashto for a high-level Al-Qaeda military officer. He was accused of participating in a hand grenade attack on a Canadian journalist in March of 2002. And he was accused of being a weapons facilitator and a money facilitator for the same Al-Qaeda operative that he was translating for. Those were the three basic charges that the government made against him.
And it sounds like there's some sense that he may have been misidentified, wrongly identified for some of that, but that he perhaps was a translator?
Oh, he was a translator for the person they said he translated for. He was translating for the government of his country at the time that he was doing this work.
He's now been cleared for release. He's been deemed to be not a threat to the United States. Does that mean he can go back to Afghanistan where he's from, or will he be required to relocate in another country?
Well, we're hoping that he'll be returned to Afghanistan. We have a individual in the Afghanistan government who knows our client extremely well, and he'll be making an effort to clear the way, if that's the right phrase, for his return to Afghanistan. And Dave and I will be working with the State Department here in the United States, which is the department of the government that makes the arrangements to move the prisoners from Guantanamo to wherever they're going to go. But he's got an extended family in Afghanistan, and our hope is that he'll be returned there.
Extended family that includes two wives and children as well that still live there.
That's correct. He's got three children, one of whom he's never seen. He has two wives, which It's part of the culture of the country. His father-in-law is a wonderful person. I've talked to him quite often. And he's got a really good family that will welcome him home.
He's been cleared for release. Do you have a sense now of how long it takes from this announcement to when he can actually leave the prison? Because from my understanding, there are quite a few prisoners at Guantanamo who have been cleared for release but are not yet gone.
I know of one Afghanistan citizen who was cleared for release last September, and is still in Guantanamo. I don't know what the holdup with him is. There are two Yemenis who were cleared for release in 2009, and they're also still in prison in Guantanamo.
So you don't have a sense of how long it will take for Abdul Zahir to be able to actually leave?
I really don't. All I can say is we're going to try as hard as we possibly can to make it happen very quickly.
It sounds like your client wasn't the only one recently cleared for release. On the same day, the ACLU put out a statement saying that Mohamedou Ould Slahi was also released. He's known for his Guantanamo diary, which was published last year. Do you know, Bob Ginsburg, was there a batch of detainees who went before the Periodic Review Board and were all cleared at the same time, or is it just coincidence that we've gotten at least a couple of names coming out at the same time?
I kind of think it's both. I think that the PRBs are accelerating their efforts to hold the hearings that the statute requires. And so as time goes on, I think the process is accelerating, and so there'll be more and more decisions coming down in the near future.
Although there aren't that many prisoners left, right? When you and David Slay started going down to Cuba and representing Abdul Zahir, there were hundreds of prisoners. Now there's under 100?
There are 76, I think, there right now. I think this is, among other things, I think it's part of the president's effort to, he can't close Guantanamo, so it's part of his effort to reduce the population there as much as possible.
Attorney Bob Ginsburg is one of the lawyers representing Abdul Zahir, a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay who's just been cleared for release after 14 years in the prison. Bob, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for asking me.
And let's go now to Cleveland, where the Republican National Convention ended last night with Donald Trump's acceptance speech. VPR's John Dillon has spent the week with the Vermont delegates there. Before flying home this morning, John gave us his impressions of last night's main event, the speech by the nominee himself, Donald J. Trump.
Well, I think people were impressed. I mean, these are obviously diehard Republicans, and many, many, many are Trump fans, so they weren't being super critical. But it was a really long speech. Some compared it to President Nixon's Law and Order speech in 1972. It had a lot of criticism about the country, and I guess if your slogan is make America great, you've got to say why America is horrible. And that's what he did. And people talked about their reflections where Trump sort of nailed his critique of the economy, crime. I think there's a lot of fear out there, especially among the delegation, about increased crime, about immigration. So they thought he really captured that. And then, you know, the mood of these conventions, the goal of these conventions is to really whip up the faithful. So the criticism of the Obama administration, Obamacare, and then, of course, Hillary Clinton hit home for a lot of people.
Does that stand for the Vermont delegation as well? I know there are some non-Trump supporters in the Vermont delegation, but you felt like they were sort of swept along as well?
I do. I mean, I think they come out of here. I think only one or two will not vote for Trump, but they come out of here fired up and believing that critique of the Obama record and then what the GOP describes and certainly everybody here was describing as another Obama term with Hillary Clinton.
So Donald Trump actually mentioned Bernie Sanders in his speech last night and predicted that millions of Sanders supporters will wind up turning around and voting for him, Donald Trump. Now, Bernie Sanders put a photo of himself on social media watching the Trump speech, and he, of course, avowed his support for Hillary Clinton. Any impressions, John?
Yeah, he made that point after talking about trade issues. He said Sanders was right about that, and then he segued and said, you know, millions of Bernie's people are going to come to me. I think there's something to it. I think it's definitely a thing. I don't know if it's millions or hundreds of thousands, but this is purely an anecdote. But last night I found a relatively quiet place to work, and it was near where the arena staff, you know, hundreds of people who were working there all week, it's near where they got fed. And young guy, African-American college kid, sat down where I was, and we talked for over an hour. And this guy was a business major, a Cleveland native, and he was a Sanders supporter. This is his first election, and he's in a swing state, Ohio, obviously, and he's taking it really, really seriously, and he's seriously thinking about voting for Trump. What I heard from him is the Hillary baggage message, you know, that was being hammered on so much this week, and maybe that's where he was coming from, but he says he can't really trust her, that she lied about her emails in Benghazi. And he studied her positions, you know, on the economy, on foreign affairs, and he's really on the fence.
And he was there to make some money, not to be a participant at the convention?
Oh, yeah. No, he was working. This was his job. This was his vacation week, and they asked him to work. And he jumped at it, obviously. He wanted to be a part of history.
In your reporting this week, you've been describing that the participants at the convention, all the delegates and everybody who's there inside the convention events, have been kind of in a bubble, and that's partly because of security. Can you describe that bubble and what it's like to be both inside and outside it?
Yeah. So to get in, first of all, you have to apply months in advance. You have to get Secret Service clearance, get clearance, and for the media, you have to get clearance from a congressional press office. And then to get actually inside the arena, you go through a double line of literally a phalanx of police officers lined up, and you kind of walk through the middle of that, and there's the general public on either side. And then once you're in, you know, of course, there's this huge security screening process. And then inside, there's also a caste system of access where certain badges get you inside the perimeter but not inside the arena, and then whether you can get on the floor. And then there's the upper echelons, literally, of the arena where the VIPs party, and that's super selective. I wandered into one area, and they kicked me out. I just was trying to find a quiet place. Anyway, so it really is convention world and then the real world. And the delegates they're not experiencing the real world. I mean, they have to go through all the security too. And that was just my overall feeling, that you're inside this place that's so separate from what's happening in the world outside for this week.
It sounds almost like it's like being in Las Vegas, that you're just in this sort of bizarro place where time and space have no real reality.
You know, somebody else made that comparison, like being in a casino, and obviously they're not betting or anything like that, but you're in there, and at one point I was in there for hours, and then I walked outside and I realized it was still daylight. So it does. There's this physical and psychological separation of being inside the event and then getting outside into the normal world.
And did you get to do that at all and see what was happening in the real world?
Yeah. Yesterday I went out a lot, and, you know, it was a spectacle both inside and outside. There was demonstrators of every persuasion, communists, socialist worker party, pro-Trump, anti-Trump. There was a theater, street theater outside, and then just huge security presence. I'm sure it's been described in detail elsewhere, but police agencies from all over the country, highway patrols from dozens of states. And so in this place called the Public Square, which was sort of the designated protest zone, when I was there, for a lot of it, the police officers outnumbered the protesters. It was that heavy a security presence.
So, John, you're about to get on a plane and come home. Presumably, the Vermont delegation is making its way back to Vermont. Do you think this week, this convention week, does anything to galvanize or direct the focus of the Vermont Republican Party moving towards November?
I'm not sure what the overall benefit is from this convention for the general election for the GOP. Remember, the Vermont GOP leadership isn't here, and I think that signals sort of a division in the party from its leaders to the rank and file, because Phil Scott stayed away, Bruce Listman, his primary opponent in the gubernatorial race, has yet to endorse Trump. The folks here who are part of the grassroots and party faithful are fired up. They do think that Trump has brought new people into the party. But the party leaders have made the choice to stay away and distance themselves. I mean, no one said that more clearly than former Governor Jim Douglas, who is he's sort of the elder statesman of the party in Vermont. And he was for John Kasich, condemned Donald Trump. He was initially thinking of coming here to try and work on a Kasich insurgency, but that didn't work out. So they are divided, and what the net boost is to the party in the state, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there is one.
VPR's John Dillon reporting still one last time here from Cleveland. He was at the Republican National Convention. John, thanks for your reporting. Safe travels home.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Next week, VPR's reporting team brings you coverage from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Our campaign coverage is supported by the VPR Journalism Fund. Coming up, we're going to be switching gears. We'll be talking about wedding toasts, specifically how to avoid being the guy who gives the awful wedding toast, the one that witnesses remember and talk about for years. We'll get tips and advice, and we still want to hear about the best and worst wedding toasts you've experienced, too. You can post your stories on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Summertime is prime time for weddings, especially in this part of the world. And if you're going to any, you've probably been subjected to at least one, maybe four or five wedding toasts. The traditional toast is given by the best man, but there's also the maid of honor, the father of the bride, and anyone else the couple has deemed worthy, or sometimes the random guest who deems him or herself worthy to give a spur-of-the-moment tribute to the happy and suddenly horrified celebrants. Popular movies are riddled with questionable and objectionable wedding toasts, but very few we could actually broadcast. So we selected this ham-handed attempt by Hugh Grant in Four Weddings and a Funeral to illustrate some of the pitfalls you might want to avoid when called upon to deliver the toast.
This is only the second time I've ever been a best man. I hope I did the job all right that time. A couple in question are at least still talking to me. Unfortunately, they're not actually talking to each other. The divorce came through a couple of months ago. But I'm assured it had absolutely nothing to do with me. Apparently, Paula knew that Piers had slept with her younger sister before I mentioned it in the speech. The fact that he slept with her mother came as a surprise, but I think was incidental to the nightmare of recrimination and violence that became their two-day marriage. Anyway, enough of that. My job today is to talk about Angus, and there are no skeletons in his cupboard. Or so I thought.
I don't know. Sounds like a great toast to me. We're going to spend a summer Friday reliving memorable wedding toasts and getting some tips on how to avoid the cringeworthy ones. Listeners, tell us about the best and the worst toasts you've experienced at weddings gone by, maybe at your own wedding even. Or call with your conundrum if you've been called upon to give a toast in the next few months and you're feeling stuck. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We are joined for some guidance now by Lizzie Post, president, author, and spokesperson for the Emily Post Institute. Lizzie, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What's wrong with Hugh Grant's toast?
Actually, I love that toast because it is hysterical.
Yeah, I mean, everybody laughed. He got the crowd laughing.
He was getting a good laugh. Probably went a little too far, obviously, for a movie. It's supposed to be comedic and everything. But you don't really want to be airing those skeletons in the closet during a toast like this. You really want to focus on the bride and groom and how this is the start of their marriage. Get sentimental. Be sweet.
Have you heard some bad toasts in your time?
I have heard some bad toasts. They mostly involve just going on way too long about the relationship that the person giving the toast has with just one of the couples. So they're not highlighting the couple. But probably the worst was a friend of mine told me he made the mistake of actually saying, well, you know, Charlie has me to thank every time let's just say they have a nice night together. Can we put it that way? Is that tame enough for public radio? Okay. Because I introduced them and it was like, oh man. And this guy's actually getting married this fall. So I'm dying for all the people he's been best men for to come back and give him these great toasts.
Probably okay to say that in a toast at the bachelor party. Yeah. Not so good when the parents of the bride and groom are there and all of these, you know, other people who may not find that as humorous.
Absolutely.
All right. So some key do's and don'ts that are going to separate a good wedding toast from a bad wedding toast.
Sure. So a really great wedding toast is, number one, short. It is not long-winded. Stick to a minute or two at most. Another really good tip is focus on the couple. Don't worry about your relationship to one of the couple or the couple themselves. Instead, just focus on the couple. How great they are together. How much you knew that it was just perfect when they got together, and you're so glad to see that they then, you know, got to this day together. Those kind of things are the right way to go.
We got a note from Terry in Stowe who says, I've heard some great, passionate, moving toasts, but I have also experienced some train wrecks. If one is composing a toast and finds himself or herself referencing divorce, hard drug use, or former spouses of the newly married couple, maybe you should be advised to scrap what you've written and start again, please.
I totally agree with that statement. Oh my gosh, the past is not the thing to be bringing up during a toast that's supposed to highlight a couple's future.
I want to hear, listeners, if you have experienced a bad toast or maybe given one. Some of Lizzie's friends have come clean to her on the bad toasts they've given. You can come clean to us. Nobody will hear it. It's just the two of us. Let me know what you've said, or maybe at your own wedding or just a wedding that you've been to, the one that lingers. Is it a good toast that you remember or a bad toast that you remember? My proposition is I think we remember the bad toasts more than the good toasts. So prove me wrong. Give me a call on either score, 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Lizzie, is it okay to crib if you are asked to give a toast and you're not a particularly eloquent writer, you're worried about giving it to? I mean, I know this is a bad week to talk about cribbing anything from the internet, but is it okay to look at speeches or templates to try to create your own so that you can do what you want to do for the couple?
I think that there are some classic things, toasting to, you know, health and happiness, to a bright and beautiful future. These are the very simple ones that you can do that people love them because they're short, they're true, they're sweet, they're nice. I think that's fine. I actually sort of stole someone's toast one year. My best friend Estelle got married, and I was talking with the best man the night before, and he talked so much about how this couple, they're both independently pursuing their own lives, but they're supporting each other and doing that together. And it was so beautiful. I said, you know, Glenn, could I use that in the speech tomorrow? And I credited him for it when I did it. So I think maybe if you give credit where credit's due, that would be one way to handle that situation, because I think none of it's terribly original, but I think that's one way to kind of handle owning up to the fact that it's not terribly original.
Yeah, but if your credit is, I found this on goodweddingspeeches.com, that's not going to go over well.
Maybe not. Maybe that's one where you can get away with just letting it slide and just saying the toast.
I mean, better that probably than giving a really terrible toast, right? Or making yourself so nervous that you can't even start and can't say anything.
I agree completely. I would rather have someone do that than to really fumble or to go the roasting route where they try to make it comedic and that sort of thing.
All right. Well, I want to get into this idea of comedic because comedy is so hard to pull off in any setting. But in the wedding toast, I mean, frankly, the one really wonderful toast that I remember from all the weddings that I've been to was really funny. But that's so hard. It's such a big pitfall. So let's get a guest in here who can maybe help us a little bit with this idea of how to use or not use humor. Jason Lorber is both a comedian and a justice of the peace in Burlington, so he ought to know a thing or two about incorporating humor into a wedding speech. And he joins us now. Jason, nice to talk with you.
Hey, great to be here, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So Lizzie gave us a few of the key do's and don'ts, and one of the don'ts could also be don't use humor unless you're actually funny. can you explain why humor in a toast is such a potential pitfall?
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, you do need to be credentialed if you're going to use humor.
Good to know. Okay.
We just passed that law last year. So you want to be careful as a comedian, even being on stage and preparing, I can't tell you the number of times I bombed, but it's more than one. And it's painful. But then when you add to it that you're really there to support the couple and it's not about you. So if you need to be guided and be clear, and Lizzie said that as well, that it's not about even just one part of the couple, that you want to be as inclusive as you can. And so when you're preparing your speech, you want to, yeah, you want to make it funny, but it needs to be funny for a reason.
So how do you do that? Do you try, you know, bouncing it off other people that you know and see what their reaction is?
Always a good idea. Always. Never try out new material on the audience, whether you're a comic or giving a wedding toast. And often when you do bounce your toast off a friend or loved one, they might add to it and give you a joke or something that goes with it, or a sentiment that also works.
Jason, this must be a problem for you, though. If you've given any wedding toasts, are you just expected to be funny? How do you handle that?
I prepare.
So you do. You do use humor yourself.
Yes, I've been to 73, or I've officiated at 73 weddings, and I've been to 19 myself, including three of them that were my own. Just like Donald Trump, I had three weddings, except the difference was that all three of mine were to the same person, because my husband and I are gay, and we had a real wedding, and then our civil union, and then the legal one. And Donald didn't come to any of them.
But, oh, too bad.
Yeah, he tried to crash one of them, but he couldn't get past. We built a big wall, and he couldn't get around it. what I do when I'm preparing a speech for a couple is sometimes I'll just go and talk to them first, and I'll find out some good points. If you're preparing a wedding speech, you can ask them things like, so how did you guys meet? And you find out their stories, or how was the proposal, or what do you love about each other? What does marriage mean to you? And in talking to them, you can get some tidbits, and you can find the funny, quirky things. That those are great. You know, your job is not to embarrass them or roast them, but it's to add some color to the event.
Jason Lorber is a justice of the peace and a comedian who lives in Burlington. And I don't know if you hold the record, Jason, but three weddings to the same guy. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, Liz Taylor's got nothing on me.
Jason, thanks for your advice. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
We're talking about good and bad wedding toasts today. We want to hear your stories of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Glenn is calling in from Orange, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. I have a memory. It's not exactly a toast, but this was a big, fat Italian wedding, and the groom sang a song, That's Amore, When the Moon Is the Sky Like a Big Pizza Pie.
Uh-huh.
It was great.
And it, so it was great. Good? It was a good moment? It didn't flop? He sang it well?
Oh, man, it made everybody happy.
Glenn, thanks for sharing that story. There is something about, you know, if you can even take something that's a surprise in your wedding, but it makes everybody happy, what a great moment. Mm-hmm. Let's hear from Tony in Wethersfield. Hey, Tony, go right ahead.
Hi.
Thank
you. I attended a wedding where the father of the bride delivered a long and rambling toast, almost exclusively effusing about his well-deserved daughter. And he was followed immediately by the stepfather of the bride. And the stepfather of the bride's toast was, there's an old Hebrew story that the length of the wedding is inversely proportional to the length of the toast. Congratulations to the bride and groom. And that's that.
But Tony, so you had a great moment after perhaps a bad moment, but maybe more strife in the family after that. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. But there was already plenty. There was already plenty there.
Oh, that's too bad to hear. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. I ought to do well then. I eloped. I didn't even have a wedding ceremony, so my marriage will be long and fruitful. We're talking today about wedding toasts. We're getting some tips from Lizzie Post. Lizzie, anything that we should know about in terms of if you are the couple, if you are the one being toasted, how do you respond? I mean, maybe with just a frozen smile on your face, but how else?
No, absolutely. It's funny. There is this tradition, and it's one that has a lot of pressure towards it because everyone takes a sip at the end, and technically the person who's being toasted is not supposed to take that sip because it's kind of like agreeing with all of the wonderful things that someone just said about you, which is not a bad thing to do. We live in an era of self-confidence, you know, self-worth, but at the same time, it's not the time and place to do it.
But so you've set up the whole wedding to celebrate yourself. Why wouldn't you take a drink saying, yes, I agree.
It's that moment of modesty, I guess, that we try to place back into the whole shindig that really is, you're right, huge celebration of yourself. But I really think that is one thing that people get confused about. And so now I hope lots of people will say, okay, no, not to drink right now. And that's okay. That having everyone else drink doesn't mean you have to take that sip.
Plus, depending on how many toasts you are having in your wedding, and, you know, many couples do not want to get too inebriated at their wedding. Right. And there's a lot of opportunity where people are trying to sort of pressure you to drink. So that's one that you could take the opportunity not to.
It is. And a lot of people think you have to toast with alcohol. You absolutely do not have to. Ginger ale, sparkling water, sparkling cider, things like that are all perfectly appropriate.
And if somebody like the guy that Tony mentioned is going on and on and on, whose job is it to shut them down?
That's really hard because it depends on why they're going on long and long. If they've been going on long because they're the ones who had one drink too many and they're really not aware. You, it's very delicate, but if you have someone who's skilled at this, they can step up and say, you know, John, what an amazing sentiment. Let's all cheers to the bride and groom. You know, that would be a way that you could tactfully cut someone else off, but it is very hard. It's in fact why we suggest that whoever's DJing or MCing or, you know, the band leader has a no mic list. And it's, you know, these are the only people allowed to give toasts. And
don't
that's
give
it.
The mic to Aunt Sally.
Nobody else. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
And do that in advance because I was at a where somebody was going on and we were sort of all looking at each other like, whose job is it in the wedding party
who's
to do
step
this?
Up? You might even, if you're worried about that happening and you don't have a list, you might even have just someone on deck who's kind of your keep the things moving person,
with
your
the
MC.
Big cane.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. More to come. Listeners, you can tell us about your disasters or the really wonderful wedding toasts you've heard. We don't mean to suggest that they're all disaster. There are really wonderful wedding toasts, and it can be a great moment at what is a great event. So tell us about your wedding or a wedding you've attended, or, you know, it's always fun to talk about the bad ones, isn't it? 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking about wedding toasts, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you've been to enough weddings, you've probably heard them all. What's the recipe for a great wedding toast, and what's the most memorable one you've heard for its awesomeness or for how absolutely terrible it was? And how do you avoid bombing if you're ever asked to give a toast? If you are in that position and you have a question about how to say something right, how to get the right tone, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your stories on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with Lizzie Post, president, author, and spokesperson for the Emily Post Institute. She's also co-host of the Awesome Etiquette podcast. And one of our producers, Lizzie, Sam Gail Rosen, said, "Good toasts are all alike. And every bad toast is bad in its own way." So we're cribbing there from Tolstoy. But what do you think about that?
I think that's actually absolutely true. I think all the good things you can say are things that we kind of know, and they are very similar. But bad toasts really are unique. And that can kind of, it's why they're memorable. It's why we talk about them here.
So it's okay to be derivative. I mean, should you, if you're giving a toast and you're worried about it, should you just try to be middle of the road, average, unmemorable?
I don't want to encourage people to go into it thinking they're going to be unmemorable, but don't try to outdo it. You know, don't try to be so special. This is someone else's special day. Let them be the special part of it. Just try to say something that you feel honest and good and you know, a little warm and fuzzy about.
Is it okay to say no?
Yeah. If you really don't want to give a toast, you can say, you know, I appreciate this honor so much, but I really am not the, I'm not comfortable with this. I'm not the right person for this. And that's how you decline.
Yeah. I can see that getting sticky.
It's hard, but also you don't want to be up there giving a toast if you really are the person that, you know, is going to, the mic's shaking in your hand and you're drooling a little or a twitch start. I mean, like any of these things that make you totally uncomfortable, you shouldn't feel you have to bear them in order to do a nice sentiment.
Okay. We got a note from Megan Rutland who says, about 15 years ago, we were at a family wedding weekend in South Carolina, and the father of the groom was giving a toast at the rehearsal dinner. He went on and on about how excited he was that he and his wife were expecting their first child and couldn't wait for the birth. He then continued by saying with a sense of disappointment that the baby was a boy and he didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to do either, as this was speaking at his son's rehearsal dinner. He tried to make the story into how great it was to have the son, but I'm not sure anyone really heard that part after the shock and awe factor. The damage had been done. Awkward. And see, this is 15
Super
years
awkward.
Ago, and Meg still remembers it.
Well, she just remembers even the details of the speech, not that it was just bad. It's all the details. That is really awkward, and that's the one where you got to remember that just not everyone's accustomed to public speaking. Not everyone's accustomed to doing this right, and hopefully son was able to forgive father, and they had a nice little conversation afterwards.
Let's go to Elise, calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Elise. Go ahead.
Hi. I actually had an amazing speech at my wedding about 6.5 years ago. My father did the toast, and what he did was he pulled out two chairs, he sat me in one, and then he sat himself in another, and he basically did the whole toast just to me. So he told me how much he loved me, he told me what a great daughter I was, and how I picked a wonderful person, and all my relatives kept chiming in, and he'd be like, oh, somebody has that window open. I can't hear what you're saying. So he made it very personal and very much about our relationship. So he didn't even play to the room. He played to me, and I can't even say how much it meant to me. And even my husband was crying. So it was an amazing thing. And I would just say, make it personal. Make it about the people that you're celebrating.
Elise, thank you for sharing that. And it sounds like it is a wonderful memory for you. And, you know, speaking of making it personal and telling a story, let's bring another voice in here. Sean Prentice is a professor of English at Norwich University, and he also edited a book on creative nonfiction, which, I mean, I guess essentially is what a wedding toast sort of is. Sean, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much, Jane. Great to be back.
So Elise saying her father made it really personal, made it about the couple, but made it personal and talked to her. You know, is that something that you would say, yeah, that's one of the key tips is make it personal?
Yeah, and especially when you're making it personal, you want to make sure that you're telling stories that are specific to that couple, rather than just talking about the vague ideas of love, you know, like this couple is beautiful and you should see how loving they are, because people just don't feel that when you tell about a couple. You really need to show how beautiful that couple is.
So you better have some anecdotes. You better know the couple and not just one of them in that case.
Yeah, and you want the anecdotes. Here's a real quick bit of science. There's two parts of the brain. There's the upper brain and the lower brain, and this is really basic science. But the upper brain is where we do all of our thinking. So if I ask you what 2 times 8 is, that's your upper brain. But if I tell you a story and you can see it, feel it, hear it, taste it, touch it, then what happens is those stories, say I ask you to, I tell you about a smell, maybe a beautiful meal he cooked for her, that part of your brain lights up and you feel as if you're actually smelling that meal. So the more specific we get, the more we can live in the stories and the more we feel it.
Sean, do you think that the toast should be for the couple or for the crowd, however small or large it is? Are you playing to the room and trying to get the room involved in this feeling of love towards the couple, or are you just speaking to the happy couple?
I always talk to my students about knowing who your audience is, and obviously a wedding is for the bride and groom, but it's also for those other 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 people there. So I would say your number one audience is the bride and groom, but you have to think about those other people.
So other tips that you have for making a really great wedding toast? I mean, as an English professor, we're counting on you here to give us the goods.
Well, the first thing I'd say is come up with an outline. Figure out what you want to say. And as we've talked about today, we've all gone to those weddings where people go off their cuff, and it just spirals out of control. So that's the first thing. Come up with an outline. Second, think of those stories that will get the reader or the listener feeling emotion. So again, don't tell, show. And then the next thing is time yourself. Figure out how long you want to go and make sure you fit into that. I mean, how often has someone spoken for 10, 15 minutes and just you sucking all the energy out of the wedding?
So don't do that. Maybe like 3 or 4 or 5 max?
That's what I would say. I always say more or less, the shorter the better. This is not about you. It's about them. So keep it nice and quick. And then the final thing is practice. You might have a great idea. You might have great stories. But if you don't practice, you might just stumble and really destroy it. So take the time at home and walk around and say it out loud. Ask your partner to critique it for you. Practice in front of a mirror so you can see what sort of weird things you do as you talk. And then hopefully you give a great speech, or at least like you all were talking about, a really good speech that doesn't take away from that wedding.
Yeah, it's like a graduation speech. Sean Prentice is an English professor at Norwich University, and he's the author of Finding Abby, The Search for Edwin Abbey and His Hidden Desert Grave. Sean, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Talking about wedding toasts today, and let's go to John calling in from Waitsfield. Hi, John. What are you thinking?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I feel honored to talk to a lady with the name Post, so I guess this is an etiquette question. Very personal, very specific. I was at a wedding, and one of the relatives of the bride, his toast skewed towards his faith identity. It was the marriage of two families who shared very different levels of faith, both Christian, but one was stronger than the other. So the toast became very Christ-like, very love along the lines of the Bible. And it was a sentiment which the entire room wasn't really behind. I'm wondering the etiquette of bringing in these very personal ideas, certainly not politics, but even faith into a toast, if that's a no-go, or if there's a way to make that work.
John, thanks for the call. Lizzie Post?
Oh, my goodness. I think that's actually one of the toughest questions that I've ever heard asked about toasting, because you're in a room with people who, some of them are really going to be behind this completely. You are playing to the audience in some ways, and yet others might really not be. And I think that when you are coming from a place, whether they're different faiths or just different strength in faith, I think it's really important to kind of go the middle of the road with it. Maybe some references to God and Christ and that in this particular situation would have been great, but not quite so heavy-handed. And I think it's really wonderful when the person giving the speech can recognize that even if their own views aren't quite the whole of the room, that they play to the whole room.
All right, we're getting short on time here, but Anne is calling in from Wallingford, and Anne, I want to make sure we have time to get to you. So go ahead and make it brisk.
20 years ago, a good friend of ours got married, and the best man did everything that Liz said not to do. How the groom and he had all kinds of female conquests, and they had wild drinking parties, and we all, our circle to this day, still talks about how horrific that toast was. All the things not to do.
And do any of you still stay in touch with that guy?
Not at all. They're divorced. We still are good friends with the woman that got was the female part of that union, and they are now divorced, thankfully.
Anne, thanks for calling in. Lizzie, again, 20 years later, and Anne is still haunted by that bad wedding toast. It's still a topic of conversation among their friends.
I know. That's just crazy. It really is. It's the bad stuff that we remember so much, and it's why it's so great to do all the things that our guests have talked about, to prepare, to think ahead of time, and to talk to the couple even to see what they're comfortable with.
I know, because the thing that this is leaving me with is the idea that I hope I am never, ever asked to give a toast, and if I am, I should say no, because there's no way to do it well. Is that true?
No, there are tons of ways to do it well. We've heard a couple good examples, right? You got to remember the good examples we've heard, Jane. Go for that. Use that as the sort of the thing you're going to go after. Sorry, lack of words.
Which is why you should practice your toast beforehand.
Exactly.
And you've given at least one. How many toasts have you given, Lizzie?
I've given toasts for other things in my life, but only one wedding toast. My sister and her husband didn't really want toasts at their wedding, so my father was the only one who gave one, and I was a maid of honor once, so that was the time that I gave one, and that was it for weddings.
And maybe we should remember, you know, bottom line here is cut people some slack. It's a happy event. Try to keep the happiness in your mind and your heart, and even when you're listening to the speeches, maybe don't be the critic that you normally are.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Phew. Lizzie Post is president, author, and spokesperson for the Emily Post Institute. She's also co-host of the Awesome Etiquette podcast, and you can hear an excerpt of the podcast on VPR on Sunday mornings at 10:40. Lizzie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
That does it for today. We want to let you know that coming up the first week of August, we're hosting Debate Week on Vermont Edition. If you've only been paying occasional attention to the primary races, this is your chance to hear the candidates make their case for your vote. And we want your questions for them. What do you want to ask? Go to vpr.net to submit your questions for governor, lieutenant governor, and treasurer candidates. You can record your question on your smartphone's voice memo app and send it to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Then tune in for Debate Week, the first week in August here on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a great weekend.